This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Oh, I want full transparency in the food industry. I want to get rid of food fraud. I mean, if we can get to that point, that would be fantastic.
As most of us have been hunkering down over the last few months, we've been shopping for more of our own food and eating out less. As you've perused the seafood section of the grocery store, you may have wondered to yourself what type of fish is okay to buy. This week on Sea Change Radio, we look at seafood supply chains with Espen Barata, who heads up IBM Food Trust Europe. He works with the company's clients in the aquaculture industry to help them implement blockchain technology to track the quality of sustainably farmed or fished seafood. Then we dive into the archives to speak with Bay Area educator and entrepreneur Kirk Lombard to learn more about his sustainable seafood delivery service, Sea Forager. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Espen Barata. He handles business development for IBM Food Trust Europe, and he's joining us from Norway. Espen, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Where are you exactly in Norway right now?
Actually, way up in the mountains in Norway, in a small place called Beitostøl, high up in the mountains.
Well, that sounds lovely and probably quite virus-free.
Yeah, this area is completely clean.
So first, before we dive into some of the problems that you're trying to solve with your team at IBM, why don't you first discuss the problems themselves for listeners who may have a vague idea of what safe seafood means? From a consumer standpoint, who's shopping for salmon or halibut or any kind of fish at the store, what are the problems that they should be aware of? And then I want to dive into some of the problems that you and your team are trying to solve.
Well, first of all, you want to be, you know, confident that the fish you buy is comes from a sustainable source, right? Be that sustainable fisheries, be that, you know, sustainable aquaculture, to be confident that that's the product you're buying. Of course, you want to know that it is a healthy product, right? That if it is a farmed fish, that it's not been, you know, fed anything it shouldn't have been. It's been a lot of rumors in this industry about, you know, what fish in various parts of the world are fed. You want to be confident that it's clean, safe, and comes from a sustainable source and has been either harvested or raised in an ethical way. So there are many issues, right?
Sure. And usually we would consider somebody from a safe seafood coalition or somebody from the seafood industry to be working on these problems. But why is IBM invested in your division, the Food Trust Europe, and explain how blockchain technology plays a role in all of this?
First of all, I think it's really important to point out that we are actually partnering with the industry, right? This is not an IBM initiative. We're doing this in partnership with a local actor here in Norway, Atea, and also with the Seafood Association. So this needs, in my opinion, to be driven by the industry, for the industry. So this is not something, you know, which is a purely IBM initiative. What we bring to the table is, of course, advanced technology that enables the connections in the supply chain here. And that's where blockchain plays a significant role, is actually in connecting the dots in the supply chain, allowing each actor to share information in a safe and secure manner, and maintaining ownership of that data throughout the supply chain as such. So there are many various actors in the supply chain, and you want to keep track of them all and make sure that your product reaches the consumer in the best possible way.
Now, Espen, if you can break down how the blockchain technology works with tracing seafood, that would be terrific. A lot of people have heard vague ideas of what blockchain technology means. They may have first heard about it when it comes to Bitcoin, but this is quite different, isn't it?
It's actually the exact opposite of what you're trying to do with Bitcoin. We're using this technology now to ensure that we know the identity of all the actors on the chain, right? We use it as by invitation only, so that we know who's in there, and we need to know the credentials of all the actors on the chain, unlike what it is with Bitcoin, where a lot of that is hidden, right?
Actually, why don't you take a step back and explain how Bitcoin works so that people can understand how yours is different.
It's all about a distributed network of encryption that allows random actors all over the world, hidden actors, to help with the encryption of the next transaction on the network. And one of the key features here that makes that, you know, a safe way of doing that is that the next computer or whomever actor in the supply chain is randomly picked, and the ledger is distributed. Right, so that's a mechanism for keeping global transactions. But what we do with what we call a permission network is very different, because there are less actors on the network that actually do the encryption, which is extremely important from an energy efficiency perspective as well. Right, we use what we call trust anchors. That means that there are specific nodes in the network that do the encryption and then, of course, replicate across the digital ledger or all the transactions on the network to keep it safe. And we also use it to identify uniquely each actor on the chain, because the whole idea here is to create that one-to-one true digital trust between the actors in the supply chain. That's what makes this a unique proposition.
Why don't you walk us through a haul of salmon and how your technology would work with different actors through the life cycle of this fish to market?
Sure. I think the exciting part of this is that we're capturing a lot more data than we're actually sharing. I think there's an extremely important principle here, is that all the actors on the chain, they're allowed to upload data and they remain the owners of that data. And that means that we go all the way back to genetics, right? Uploading data about the gene pool, the eggs, all relevant data before the fish is even hatched, right? We want that data. That doesn't necessarily mean that all that data travels to the consumer, right? But it enables actors in the supply chain to share that data if they want or upon request. That's an important part of it. So we capture data from hatch to what we call the smolt phase, which is the phase where the salmon is in fresh water. And then, of course, we capture all the relevant data in that period of the salmon's life. And then, of course, the period in at sea, yeah, where they live in the sea farm, and where we also integrate with various sensor systems, right, that gives you data about the salmon's life, right, health of the fish. It is integrated with other data capture systems that, you know, count sea lice, that sort of thing, in order to make sure that we can document healthy fish all the way that has had a good life, you know. And the when it's then transported by what we call well boats, right? A big haul of salmon is transported to the production facility. Then there's integration with the production lines, right? That do the actual slaughtering, that put them in fish boxes and ship them all over the world. So in order, we connect all these dots, and then that data is then available to the buyers of the fish and ultimately to the consumer. So, but that all again depends on how the actors want to share the data, right?
And how do suppliers benefit from it? Do they keep their costs down, or is it purely just they're able to ensure that their fish is sustainably caught?
When you invest a lot of money, effort, and love into, you know, raising an animal for it to be the best product it can possibly be, you really want to make sure that that information is conveyed to your buyers, to the market, and this is the, you know, the way to transfer that information in a safe and secure manner all the way to consumer. And we provide the feedback via QR codes on packages. You can actually scan this in store and get the entire story, and that allows for the farmer or for the aquaculture operator to actually tell their story. And they're really keen to be transparent about their operation because they're proud of what they do, right? And there are a lot of myths about this industry that are no longer true, right? So a lot of stories you hear about this industry might have been true, you know, 25 years ago, but it's not there today. Today is a very clean, efficient industry. So they really want to tell that story, and that's important.
And how much is this focused on the Norwegian salmon fishery market and Europe and the U.S.? This is more of a global effort, that, even though you're based in Norway, correct?
Yes, of course. IBM Food Trust is a global network for traceability of food. It's been widely adopted by the retail industry. So this is connected to that, of course, so that we can, that data travels into the production systems and also, of course, traceability systems of global retailers and also manufacturers around the world. So it is truly, truly a global movement, the whole blockchain effort that we're building.
So what would be the next real breakthrough for you and your team to get to? What is the holy grail for Food Trust Europe to attain? What are the next barometers for success you're looking at?
Oh, I want full transparency in the food industry. I want to get rid of food fraud. I mean, if we can get to that point, that would be fantastic.
Espen Brota, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Gonna close the store, put a note on the door. I feel like going fishing. I'll grab my pole, head for the old fishing hole. Feel like going fishing. 'Cause when the blues get you, you know they'll be with you. Me beat. I head for the creek and fish all my blues away. I grab my hat, throw my lunch in a bag. I feel like going fishing.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Kirk Lombard. He is the founder of Sea Forager Seafood Company. Kirk, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
So for our listeners, why don't you first explain how Sea Forager works?
Okay, well, it operates along the lines of sort of like a produce box, CSA delivery. People sign up online for a minimum of, I think, 4 deliveries. They pay a set rate, and then I choose based on what I think is most sustainable option plus what's the freshest. So, and then I provide that seafood. I deliver to various drop locations and also door-to-door service if it's requested. If it's in San Francisco, we can do that. So
what gave you the idea for this? Are there other
CSFs
around the country that do this?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's I think a growing trend. Happily, there's a few other competitors in the Bay Area, but when you look at how many different seafood companies there are, I mean, there are dozens in California. There are way fewer people who define themselves as CSFs or fish delivery packages, and so there's less competition, which is one of the reasons that I was interested in doing it, just on a business level. The way Sea Forager started is that I do walking tours where I they're very fishy, sort of fish centric, seafoody, salty walking tours. I take people around various neighborhoods and on the coastline, and I teach them about the seaweeds that grow there and the monkey face eels that live under the rocks, and we practice how to cast, how to throw casting nets, so people can catch their own small fish using the Hawaiian casting net technique. And I demystify that, because there's a lot of different people who teach how to do that online, and I have the simplest way to do it and the most effective. So I teach people how to go out and get stuff. And I was doing these tours for a couple of years, and I just started to notice that at the end of the tour, I'd get a lot of people who would ask me. They'd say, "Hey, so if I can't go out and throw a casting net and catch my own herring, or I don't have the time to go out and catch a perch on the coastline here, or go fishing for stripers or whatever, how do I get something that I know is fresh and sustainable?" So I was pointing them in various directions and just throwing a lot of business at various other, well, really there was only one or two different companies that I was really throwing people towards. And I just decided, well, since they're asking that question, why don't I provide the seafood? And with the contacts that I've made in the seafood world over the last 20 years, I've been able to do that. So, yeah, that's how it happened.
Take us back to that 20-year period a little bit. Give us a little bit of background. You have a very interesting past.
It's a hard one, because I've worn a lot of different hats. So I've done a lot of different jobs over the years. But the one thing that I always have done is I've always fished. Mostly recreationally. And I've always just been in love with being out on the water or just along the shoreline, as it were. Most of the fishing that I actually do is shore-based. So like the things that I write about in my book the most are things like monkey face eels and night smelt and surf smelt and fishing from some of the piers in the Bay Area. That's always been sort of my focus. As many different jobs and careers as I had over the years, the one thing that I always have done is been connected to the ocean in some way or another. And so I just decided at a certain point to commit to a life in seafood. I'm a true seafooditarian in the old Mr. Flood. That I'm making an obscure reference to a book by Joseph Mitchell, who has a wonderful take on American seafood in the 1930s. You can read about it in a book called Up in the Old Hotel, but he has a piece called Old Mr. Flood, which describes a person who's just passionate about seafood. And Old Mr. Flood refers to himself as a seafooditarian. And so that's how I refer to myself.
And what is the problem with being a seafooditarian in today's marketplace if you're not a conscious consumer in terms of what you're putting in your body and what you're doing in terms of supporting some of these less sustainable businesses? Why don't you explain how your business is kind of a reaction to some of the market inequities and inefficiencies?
If you don't have a conscience, then you don't have a problem. You know, you can go do anything. But if you do have a conscience and, you know, you're concerned about the plight of the oceans and the seafood resources, you know, there's some very practical things that you can do.
So what is the flip side of your business? The people who actually are conscious about seafood are your consumers, but 99% of people don't even think about where their seafood comes from. Why should they?
One thing I've just always not ever felt like it's productive to tell people what they should do. So I do what I do. And if that appeals to people, hey, I'm more than happy to provide seafood. And what I do is I always have the name of the boat. I know when the fish was landed. I give details to my customers about how those fish were landed. I'm into the story. I'm into people knowing that what we provide on a weekly basis depends on a lot of factors. It depends on the skill of the guy going out and getting those fish. It depends on how big the swell is. It depends on what is migrating and what is available and what quotas have been reached, all of that stuff. If you're not attuned to that, then you come to think that it's just always there. And the problematic seafood, as I see it, is the stuff that's just always there. So a major component of what we do is to educate. And, you know, people don't sign up for Sea Forager unless they're open to that. You know, every now and then I get somebody who writes me an email saying, hey, you know, I could have gotten such and such a fish for half of what you're charging. And then I say, well, first of all, how do you know that such and such a fish is even the species that you're buying? The New York Times did a study. What was it? It was either 40 or 60% of all American seafood is mislabeled to the species level. That is just insane. So you're buying tuna. How the hell do you know what you're getting? Anyway, so I let alone how it was caught, when it was caught, where it was caught, who caught it, how they were treated, how much they were paid for that. I mean, all of that stuff. Once that becomes a mystery, then it's just there's openings for, you know, the miserable treatment of the ocean and the fisheries. I try to take that mystery out.
And the people who are part of that as well are down the whole supply chain. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of misery there as well. We've chronicled some of the work in Southeast Asia.
Oh, man. Have you ever seen on one of my tours or at one of my talks, I met a guy who was working on a film. It was called, it's a really darkly humorous title. It was called Grinding Nemo.
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. So if you're having a really bad day, do not go and see this movie. If you're having a really good day and you just think that you're flying too high and you want to bring yourself down a couple of notches, go watch Grinding Nemo, which is all about the shrimp industry, I guess, in, I don't want to say the wrong country, I think it was Indonesia or something, and how they've depopulated the coastal resource to the extent that the only fish left to feed the shrimp in the coastal destroying shrimp farms that are being built, the only fish left are the clownfish, like Nemo. So they put these drag boats that drag over the tops of these coral reefs and destroy the reefs, and then they catch these little tiny fish and then they grind them into fish meal to feed the shrimp that are in the shrimp ponds that are destroying the coastal ecosystem. So and they're employing slave labor to do this. Now you don't need to watch the movie, but you should check it out anyway because it will really impress you.
The morning, laughing happy fish heads. In the evening, floating in the soup. Fish heads, roly-poly fish heads. Fish heads, eat them up, yum. Ask a fish head anything you want to. They won't answer, they can't talk.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder of Sea Forager Seafood Company, Kirk Lombard. So, Kirk, why don't you walk a potential customer, a listener, through the process if they were going to go onto seaforager.com and sign up?
Right. So you go to seaforager.com and you see there's like two possible avenues of your web surfing as you get there. So you can click on the thing that there's an icon that shows me doing tours. You can take one of my walk-in tours around the area. And I'll go over the basics of fishing and foraging the California coast, the Northern California coast. Or you can click on seafood. And if you click on seafood, then you go to a link, and it is all about Sea Forager seafood. And it sort of tells you what our governing principles are and why we're doing what we do. And you look at drop locations. I mean, I'm thinking if I was a customer, the first thing I would do is I'd say, okay, so these guys do fish drop-offs around the Bay Area. So are they in my neighborhood? So then you look up. We have about 30 different I think even more than that, 35 different locations, South Bay, San Francisco, and East Bay. And you look up, okay, so I live in Glen Park. Oh, wow, there's a Glen Park pickup on Wednesdays. And what you do is you sign up then for what you want. Are you an adventurous seafood eater and you're willing to take pretty much anything out of the ocean, which could be oysters, it could be clams, it could be squid, it could be small fish, or it could just be a fillet every now and then. If that's what you're well suited to and what you like, then you sign up for what's called the Neptune's Delight Order. And it's, I think it's a minimum of four, and you sign up for it. And every week you will go to that location and pick up your order. The other option, which I didn't mention, is called the slab order, and that's just a fillet. So you've got two options. Neptune's Delight, which could be anything out of the ocean, and the slab, which is just a fillet every week. And it's packed in ice, and it's put in a cooler, and the cooler goes, you know, in someone's porch or in the back of a cafe or something like this, or at your work location. We have a few coolers around town in businesses. And so, so then you show up and you open the cooler and you look inside and there is a package with your name on it. And you take it and you put it in your bag and you get quickly home, put it in the refrigerator, and then you eat it.
I was curious how you find people to participate in the drop-off system. How does that work?
A large percentage of my customers are just people who took my tour. And then lately we're getting a lot of people through the book, my book that was published in September 2016. And so that's how we're getting a lot. But I also do, like, I do speaking events and I do dinners where I provide all the seafood and I get up and I talk about it. And then my wife contacts like neighborhood groups and, you know, we just have a lot of contacts, a lot of word of mouth. We have flyers that go out in our bags that say, hey, if you sign up X amount of people, you get a free order, whatever. So we have all of that sort of promotional stuff and it's just been incredible how it's grown.
And you explained how one of your customers or potential customers complained a little bit about the price being more expensive than if they went down to Safeway and ordered and got a piece of fish. So how does a Safeway keep their prices so low?
Do they really? I think fish is pretty expensive around the board.
Well, but yeah, relatively.
They're cheaper than me.
How can a can of tuna be 50 cents or whatever?
Right. I suspect that the reason for that is simply that the fish are caught in huge volume and then whoever bought those fish initially paid pennies on the dollar for them.
He's the founder of Sea Forager Seafood Company, Kirk Lombard. Kirk, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Blind Faith, Bobby Charles, and Barnes & Barnes.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.